All opinions expressed here are the views of the speaker, not necessarily those of their hosts, producers, or owners.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to Socialist Can, 1 hour left. We come on every week at the same time, and we have we deal with a variety of subjects from a left perspective. Today we have a special program and a very special guest. We have Howie Hawkins, and Howie Hawkins is running as a candidate for president in the 2020 election. He aimed to boot Trump out of the Oval Office. And Howie, I'd like to thank you for joining the program today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Howie, you and I, we personally, we've known each other for almost 10 years, but we personally met when I was there at the Left Forum in 2012, and we have stayed in touch and have been friends ever since. And I was very excited about hearing that you were going to pursue running as a candidate for president in 2020. So we're going to talk about your campaign and some of the things that you plan to do. We're going to come on again in September, and we're going to discuss what your plans are on a national level in regards to what changes that you believe that how you can impact the political landscape. And also, we're going to have you back the following month, where we're going to discuss your campaign on international issues. But today, we're going to be talking about your campaign in regards to what you're doing, putting it together, what type of support you're getting from the community. So, Howie, obviously, you have become a candidate for president of the United States. First, I want to ask you, what made you decide to enter the race to become president of the United States? Howie?
Well, a bunch of people who formed a draft Howie committee while I was, I took a part-time job as a casual mail handler at the post office. I had just run for governor of New York last year for the Green Party, and took this job partly just to decompress, and they were paying a pretty good wage. I'm working 12-hour shifts, only 3 days off between the week after the election and January. Had to work Christmas, Thanksgiving, and New Year's. So I'm going to work, going to the gym, going to sleep, and back to work, minding my own business. And a bunch of Greens around the country decided I would make a good candidate. So I opened my email in January, and everybody's asking me to run.
January this year?
Yeah.
Of this year? Okay.
This year. And at first I said, well, let's find somebody. My plans, I'm retired now from UPS. I was a Teamster. I was planning to read all these books I buy faster than I can read, maybe write a couple more and do some traveling. And instead, they handed me this assignment. And as we looked around, they convinced me I should run. And I respect the people that asked me. They range from Matt Gonzalez, who was the almost mayor of San Francisco.
Gonzalez, okay.
Yep. To the late Bruce Dixon, who was a close friend, and really sorry to see him pass a few weeks ago.
Right.
And a whole lot of people. He's in Atlanta, a whole lot of people in between. And they're the kind of folks you just can't say no to when they say you're the guy that should do it. So it sort of was decided for me.
And now that you have entered the race, and obviously when I met you, I was running as a candidate for president for the Socialist Party USA, which has a lot of responsibilities in regards to having a knowledge of many of the issues that are out there, speaking for whatever organizations or political parties that you'd be representing, especially if you gain the nomination. So there's a lot of responsibilities that come with even seeking to having the desire to pursue that office. But beyond the qualifications outlined in the U.S. Constitution, what are your qualifications, Howie, to become the next president of the United States?
Well, I'd say, one, I've been a member of the Socialist Party since it reformed in 1973 after the old Socialist Party of America split three ways. And, you know, that platform, those principles are principles I've agreed to, you know, ever since then. So I think, and that just reflects the fact that I've been a movement activist since the 1960s and countless campaigns for civil rights, peace, unions, the environment, and independent working class politics. I think a unique qualification I have of everybody running for president is that I've spent my adult years as a blue-collar union worker in construction and in warehouses. And I think that brings a perspective that you don't hear too much from the people that have been or are seeking the presidency. And then I think, you know, I mentioned this Draft Howie campaign. This is really, I'm the candidate, but we have a collective leadership that's very diverse in terms of race, gender, sexual orientation, age, geography, and we're running as a team. So I have a lot of help, which I think enhances my qualifications.
And that team is, does the reach of that camp, of that team, is it beyond the scope of just the Green Party?
They are all members of the Green Party at this point, although I have been, in fact, I spoke to the New Jersey Socialist Party convention last weekend, and they passed a resolution urging me to seek the Socialist nomination as well as the Green nomination.
Was that Greg Payson?
Greg Payson, Pat Noble, the whole crew.
Pat Noble?
Yep. And so, you know, the goal is, one of the goals of the campaign is to reach out beyond who's in the Green Party now. And one of those targets for organizing and working together is independent socialists who have maintained their political class independence from the Democratic Party, which is becoming a smaller group. Right now we have a trend in the socialist movement, the people that call themselves socialists, into the Democratic Party. You know, Bernie Sanders has sort of been the Pied Piper of that, and you have the Democratic Socialists of America, the largest socialist group now. They have traditionally been oriented to the Democratic Party, although it's probably more under debate within their organization than ever before. And there are other currents on the left that have moved into the Democratic Party with Sanders and with DSA exploding in membership, you know, from 5,500 to 55,000 over the last few years. So I think one of our messages is to the socialists, the new socialists, is that we have a tradition of political independence where the working class and socialists, we speak for ourselves, we run our own candidates, we have our own identity and voice, and that gives us a lot more leverage in the political system than disappearing into the Democratic Party, where after the primary, if you want to maintain good relations with the people you want to work with in the Democratic Party, you have to support the corporate Democrat if they win the nomination. And pretty soon the socialist or left position is just lost in the sauce.
Right. You mentioned about the Socialist Party USA. I believe they have an upcoming convention, or have they had their convention yet?
It's in October in Newark, New Jersey. And I will be
now. Will you be seeking? Will you be seeking their nomination as a presidential candidate?
Yes.
Very interesting. I was part of the Socialist Party, member of the Socialist Party USA, 2006, 2007. In 2011, I was seeking the Green Party nomination with the with my affiliation already with the Socialist Party USA. Very interesting. I was rebuffed on the national level, or from the national leadership, in regards to being seeking their nomination. And I still pursued that. which later on I ran into various issues in Illinois with, I think his name is was Richard Sherman, where he objected to, it was an objection presented to the Secretary of State that prevented me from being on the ballot there in Illinois. So you just have a different approach. Instead of, you're already, committed to the Green Party, you're probably going to have a better chance of getting the nomination for the Socialist Party USA, as opposed to if it was in reverse, because you have run for public office with the Green Party how many times?
Over 20.
You have run for public office with the Greens more than 20 times?
Yeah, in New York we have elections every year. Local is the odd years, and state and federal.
But you have been in 20. You have been in 20 campaigns already, correct?
Correct.
And when you ran for governor, how many votes did you secure then?
Well, in 2014, got 184,000. That was about
5%
of the vote.
Yeah, had 184,000.
Yep.
Well, that was pretty significant. Have you formed a campaign committee, and do you have a vice president, a vice presidential running mate as of today?
I do not. We've been talking about it, and I hadn't even thought about this, but I don't know how the socialists want to handle that. We haven't even discussed that. That's a good question. Maybe I'll ask you.
What about the Greens? How are the Greens handling it?
Well, we usually name that person at the convention, which is next summer. And I would say that the Green Party's changed since 2012 when you tried. That gentleman in Illinois is no longer with us. And
yeah,
a lot of people
good.
Are upset at the way he handled that situation. And in 20,
even Jill Stein, she stepped up and said that she didn't see why that he should offer that objection. But he wouldn't pull that objection to me being on the ballot. And it was no cost other than to make certain that there was not, it was that one party, the Socialist Party USA, which was not represented there on the ballot. So just from that objection. But you're saying that the Socialist Party, obviously the Socialist Party, you can go into their convention with whoever person that you would like to put up to be nominated as a vice presidential candidate. But you had mentioned with the Green Party is done there at the convention. Is that correct?
Yeah, technically or
formally.
In other words,
you don't go into the convention with – here's a person that, you know, here's a person that I would like to have as my running mate. Is that correct?
Well, we've traditionally done that. The candidate usually announces it at the convention. We've given some thought to
right,
announcing
exactly. Okay.
Early.
It's the same way then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, because with the Socialist Party USA, I announced that person, which was Alex Mendoza, but my announcement was once I was nominated, I made that announcement there at the convention. So it's basically it's the same way.
Yeah.
But
the other thing that's changed is that the Greens have adopted a plank that says they're committed to, they call it eco-socialism or the cooperative commonwealth.
Right.
So the anti-capitalist perspective, the socialist perspective in the Green Party has grown a lot, particularly in the last 10 years. And that incident in Illinois, I think, helped precipitate the Greens getting explicit about that. So we don't have that kind of nonsense in the future.
Right. Now, I know you definitely have reached out to the Green Party, and they seem that they are very open. Are there any other persons that have indicated that they are seeking the Green Party nomination that you know of nationally?
Well, if you go to the FEC, last time I looked, there was about a dozen, but I'd say half of them were frivolous, you know, like Kanye.
Right.
Somebody called themselves Kanye D's Nuts West.
Okay.
So, you know, that somebody just filed the paperwork. There's
okay.
Probably half a dozen who have done some campaigning and come to candidate forums at the various state party conventions. But I would say, you know, my campaign is far and away the best organized. We're raising money. We're out there. We're putting out statements regularly. And the others are, you know, I don't even know what kind of campaign organizations they really have. So, you know, that's partly why when I was asked, you know, we looked around and didn't see anybody capable of pulling a campaign together organizationally. So that's where it stands right now. But, you know, you can't take anything for granted. Who thought Ralph Nader would lose to David Cobb in 2004 at the Green Party convention?
What about Jill Stein?
Jill is, I guess, recovering from running twice. You know, she's got that Senate investigation related to, you know, being in Russia and that picture that, you know, Sputnik International took of her and Putin and Mike Flynn at a sitting at a table. Putin was just there for a few minutes and they snapped a picture. She never spoke to him. And she got that. She's got FEC things to clean up. They raised a lot of money after the campaign to do some lawsuits about recounts in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. That work is still ongoing. She had to get her medical license renewed. She's been busy, and, you know, to jump on another presidential campaign, she just decided, you know, she'd done it twice. It was time for somebody else.
Yourself, Howie, running as a candidate for president of the United States, obviously you've been very involved even since the beginning of the Green Party, building that party. But my question is, do you have a greater interest in building the Green Party, or is your greatest interest directed at being elected president of the United States?
It's building the Green Party and also putting issues into
debate. Is that your primary interest?
Yes. And also shaping the debate by putting, you know, policies out there that the whole political system has to deal with. I mean, that's been the traditional role of third parties, you know, from the Liberty Party, you know, for abolition to the issues we're raising today. And so, you know, building the Green Party and building unity on the independent, non-sectarian socialist left is, you know, a central goal of our campaign. And what that means practically is securing ballot lines. You know, people say, well, why are you running for president? Why don't you start at the local level? Well, you got to have a ballot line to run locally. You know, otherwise, it's very difficult, you know, onerous petitioning requirements. So the Greens have 21 ballot lines around the country, and about 40 of all the ballot lines are up for grabs in a presidential election. It depends on – it varies from state to state because every state has a different election law, but – it depends on how many petition signatures you get to get the ballot line. You may have to get a percentage for president or another statewide office in the election, and it varies from state to state, usually 1, 2, 3, or 5%. Alabama's 20%. They really make it hard. But so getting ballot lines so that we have the just the access to the ballot, which in this country is harder than any other electoral democracy. You know, if you want to run for Congress, say in Illinois, you got to get 15,000 to 17,000 signatures in a short period. In the United Kingdom, you want to run for the House of Commons, you need 25 signatures. And it's like that. You know, Canada, it's 50 to 100, whether the riding has one or two members being elected. So that's one, you know, very concrete goal, get ballot lines. And we're spending a lot of my campaign money on that. And then the other thing we want to do as we get the ballot lines is we want to train Greens to be good organizers. You know, Greens tend to be activists. We show up. But we need to be organizers like a union organizer is or a community organizer is, who knows how to broaden the base of the organization, reach into communities that are not participating. And there are various, you know, approaches to that. It's not just about mobilizing people to the, you know, the next demonstration or the next election campaign. It's about building relationships with people in your community and in other communities so you broaden the base. And so we want to train Greens to do that, both, you know, immediately for the election, but also for the long-term strength of the party as it organizes going forward. So those are the two main, you know, objectives in terms of building the Green Party that we want to accomplish.
Now, when you go to the convention for the Socialist Party USA, that was a question that came up when I was seeking the nomination. And Jerry Levy and myself, he was seeking the nomination, and I was also seeking the nomination. And the question that was presented to both of us was about building the party, helping to build support within the country for membership as the party moved forward beyond the election. So if your interest is not necessarily to become the next president, which obviously is a very long shot, I don't even think Trump thought that he would be elected president. It was like a fluke. But, you know, corporate America, they were ready for him. But if your interest is in building the Green Party, what about when that same question come up about building the Socialist Party, Socialist Party USA? How would you respond to that question?
Well, I want to help the Socialist Party strengthen its organization so that organizer training would be open to those people. And also when we're raising issues, I think, you know, we can raise them together. You know, for example, the number of Green leaders have organized a conference on eco-socialism in Chicago on September 28th. But we're inviting Socialist Party members and other people on the left to participate in that discussion. So as we develop the program for eco-socialist transformation. And I will encourage as I campaign, you know, as one thing Michael Harrington got right, you know, the old gray eminence of the original Democratic Socialists of America. Didn't agree with him on a lot of stuff. He was totally oriented to the Democratic Party, and he tended to organize from the top down. But he had a phrase that he'd tell people, which I think is really true. There's no such thing as an unorganized socialist. If you're not part of an organization, you're not going to be effective. So, you know, it's up to people to choose which they feel most comfortable with. We have a lot of dual members down there in New Jersey. A number of those people at the Socialist Party Convention are also Green Party members. So that's the way I want to approach it. Help everybody get into organizations, and then help people learn how to be good organizers, not just activists.
It's very, very interesting. When I was looking at the leadership of the Green Party, the leadership was very opposed to me seeking their nomination. But when you look at the rank-and-file membership of the organization, I received great support across the country. And it came from the upper leadership, as far as any opposition to the campaign. Yourself, you know, running as a candidate, are you looking at other parties that you'll be seeking the nomination other than the Socialist Party USA and the Green Party, or will it be just those two?
There are state parties that have ballot lines that are independent, like the Progressive Party in Vermont, the Liberty Union Party in Vermont. And so that discussion is going on up there. There are also people who want to get a green line, too. It's a fusion state.
How well is the Liberty Union? How well are they doing at this point?
I haven't talked directly with them. I've heard from other people up there that they're diminished. Peter Diamondstone, who was kind of holding them together, I understand, passed.
And he died around 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, so I suppose Jerry Levy's still up there and some of the old people, but I'm not sure what they're doing. They do still have a ballot line, so we'll get to that conversation. There's the Peace and Freedom Party in California. There's the Citizens Party in South Carolina. There's a Labor Party line in South Carolina. So, yeah, we're going to be talking to all those folks, too.
I'm just going to move on here. I want to look a little bit more at your platform, and I'm just going to take a very brief pause here to let our listeners know that they are tuned to Socialist Can 1 Hour Left. We have a special guest on the program today, and it is a special program. We have Howie Hawkins. He's running as a candidate for President of the United States in the 2020 election, and we're very pleased to have him on the program today. Howie, I would just like to have you just very, at this point, give you contact information, and we're going to do it at the very end of the program. How can our listeners be able to reach you?
My website is howiehawkins.us, howiehawkins.us. And there you'll find the statements we put out and how to volunteer, how to donate, how to get involved if you want.
Howie, I just want to move on. What are five key points of your platform running as a candidate for president?
Well, we're running on the theme of an eco-socialist Green New Deal. I happen to be the first candidate in this country in 2010 to campaign for a Green New Deal. And that program involves two parts. One is a green economy reconstruction program to get us to zero greenhouse gas emissions and 100% clean energy by 2030. Because that's what the climate science says rich countries like the U.S. should do. And the other part of it is an economic bill of rights. Everybody should have the right to a living wage job, an income above poverty, an affordable home, comprehensive health care, good public education from pre-K through college, and a secure retirement. And this is something Roosevelt called for back in 1944 and 1945 in his last two State of the Union addresses, asked Congress to act on those goals, those rights, and they never have. So that's the second point. Third point is nuclear disarmament. I mean, we've just launched a new nuclear arms race. The nukes are on hair trigger alert. So we're calling for no first use, an end to the nuclear modernization program that just kicked off, and unilateral disarmament to a minimum credible deterrent, and on that basis negotiate under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and the new Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons with the other nuclear powers to get to complete nuclear abolition. And that's a life or death issue that's not getting the attention it should. The fourth issue would be open borders as an immigration policy. In other words, like within the EU, people should be able to be free to cross borders. They just check in. If there's not a warrant out for their arrest, they just move on and, you know, go to work, move, you know, take up residency or just shop or go for recreation. And we need to close the camps right away, provide legal status for all residents and a normal path to citizenship for those who want it. And then the fifth key point would be reparations. And that's for African Americans. We need to pass H.R. 40 to study how to do that right. We need to recognize Indian treaty rights. We need to decolonize Puerto Rico and the other territories. And the Economic Bill of Rights, I always speak of it as a down payment on reparations we can do right now as we, you know, maybe study these other things. And that's what Martin Luther King called for in the March on Washington for jobs and freedom in 1963. Before he got to the I Have a Dream part of his speech, which was ad lib, he'd done that many times, he had a text. And what he talked about was the promissory note that, you know, poor people and people of color had come to collect. And they were told, the government said there's insufficient funds, but King said, we don't believe the Bank of Justice is in default or bankrupt. And so that promissory note is the Economic Bill of Rights, and I think that's the first step toward full reparations. So those are the 5 points.
Now, when you say open borders, and obviously we have the southern border has been a matter of debate and discussion there in Washington. You have it with the Democrats, you have it with Republicans, and Americans are, as a whole, the vast amount of Americans are not really sold on open borders where anyone can just come over. As socialists, I don't believe in borders. How would you sell that one particular item of your five key points on your platform, having completely open borders? What would be your selling point?
Well, freedom of movement is a basic human right. And when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the United Nations, they said that was one of the basic rights. Now, they were aiming at South Africa's pass laws and the internal passports you needed at that time in Soviet Union and in China at that time. But borders between countries serve the same oppressive purposes. We've used Mexico as like South Africa used to use Bantustans. When we need that labor, we let them in. When we don't, we deport them. And because we're divided across that border, the working class is divided, and the capitalists use cheaper Mexican labor against American labor. And because we're divided, we're all weaker and getting less than we should. So this is something that will benefit working people in this country and recognize a basic human right. We let capital and goods, you know, flow across that border. Why not people? People are more important than capital and goods.
Much of what we have, the crisis at the border, is that crisis mainly created by this country when you consider how NAFTA has been a complete failure, how we have gone into Mexico, and obviously it's an agrarian society, and we have gone in with big corporations taking over many of the small farms, where now corporations are now using those areas for fat profits. So when you look at the problem, the crisis that is at the border, is much of that crisis, in your opinion, something that we have created as a nation, or something that is just as a result of having the flow of immigrants across the border?
Well, it certainly is a push because of NAFTA, which basically destroyed the strongest legacy of the Mexican Revolution a century ago, which established communal land, ejidos, which gave, you know, the small farmer access to grow their own food and sell their own food. And that was lost. So you have, you know, big agribusiness buying up the land and removing the protections to those small farmers that Mexico had. So people were forced off the land, and they either went to the slums by the big cities or they came north looking for work to survive. And that was a result of NAFTA. And then you can go into Central America, and we have supported, you know, that they don't call them the banana republics for nothing. You know, they have military dictatorships that the U.S. has installed, you know, going back to United Fruit and, you know, that. And most recently under Obama, there was a coup in Honduras. The elected leader, Zelaya, raised the minimum wage, and the oligarchs didn't like it, and so they grabbed him in his pajamas and shipped him out of the country, just like they did to Aristide in Haiti, in his pajamas. And, you know, that kind of interference creates terrible conditions for the working class and the small farmers, the peasantry, and repression. When they try to organize to fight back, they get killed. So that's why a lot of them come north. And so there's been a lot of push in that immigration from policies of the United States. And we can ease that pressure by having, you know, a just pro-democracy foreign policy.
You were very supportive of my 2012 campaign for president as a socialist candidate. Latest statistics show that 40% of Americans believe that socialism is a good thing. Do you support a socialist-based economy or capitalist-based economy, or is there something in between?
No, socialism should be the dominant mode of production. And, you know, there will be markets with small, you know, entrepreneurs, retail people, self-employed artisans, tradespeople, and so forth. That they've been around since the Roman Empire. But the dominant mode of production ought to be socialist, because we need a socialist economic democracy in order to have the democratic power to make the right decisions with respect to meeting everybody's basic needs and respecting ecological limits. So, you know, I like to talk about eco-socialism, 20th century socialism and 19th century socialism. A lot of the emphasis was on building up the forces of production, you know, to end poverty. Now the forces of production are enormous. That's not the problem now. Now the problem is planning production to meet the basic needs of all within ecological limits. So I like to use the word eco-socialism. And, you know, for me, socialism is economic democracy, not merely state ownership. You know, if the state is not democratic, then state ownership is just another system of exploitation or state capitalism. It still exploits through wage labor, which is the distinguishing feature of capitalism. And so it has to be democratic.
Now, when you say economic democracy, are we talking about economic democracy where big corporations get their share, or big corporations, they're eliminated, and it's all among the people of that society? What are we talking about?
We're talking about social ownership of the major means of production and democratic administration or planning of that sector of the economy. So the people have a say.
Yep.
Now, that could be a public enterprise owned by a municipality, a state, the nation. It could also be a worker co-op where the workers collectively own their firm and they share the net income that would go to profits of a capitalist. They share it amongst themselves in proportion to the labor they contribute. So everybody gets their fair, equitable, just share of the net income they create. Under capitalism, you get a fixed wage, and everything else you create goes to the capitalists. And
right.
That's the system of exploitation as much as slavery was.
We always hear that word thrown out there about democracy. We wanted to bring democracy to the people of Libya. We got rid of Saddam Hussein, and we wanted to bring those people democracy. We looked at what took place in Chile, and we wanted to bring to those people democracy. This country has turned democracy into a bad word. So when we're looking at democracy, economic democracy, are we looking at economic democracy where not only where you're benefiting from production, but people, the working people, are actually in control of the means of production as well within that society? Is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about under socialism. When, you know, U.S. imperialists say we're bringing democracy, they're bringing the opposite. You know, they had no intention of bringing democracy to Iraq. They wanted the oil. And
so
they're not talking about bringing
democracy to Venezuela today.
Oh, well, yeah, Elliot Abrams and John Bolton and these war criminals.
Criminals.
Yeah, they have never supported democracy. They don't even want it for us in the United States. They want, you know, they represent, you know, the ruling class, the elites, and they are right-wingers who think the less voice the people have, the better. So, you know, they're not about bringing democracy to Venezuela. That's another war for oil.
Right. We're looking at 40% of Americans now believe socialism is a good thing. 40%. That's a huge number. What is the message that you see that you're carrying, that you're helping to that 40% grow? Why are people saying, I think socialism is a way to go as opposed to capitalism? What is the message that's out there that you have been dealing with for well over 40 years and that you see in your circles that people now are leaning toward socialism as opposed to capitalism? Why are they turning in that direction, in your opinion, Howie?
Well, I think there are three reasons. One is they like what they heard from Bernie Sanders, which wasn't really socialism. It was New Deal liberalism. But he called himself a socialist. And they said, yeah, Medicare for all makes sense. Yeah, tuition-free public college makes sense. A living wage for a minimum wage, a $15 minimum wage, makes sense. They support that. And if that's socialism, they're for it. The second reason is capitalism hasn't been treating the working class very well, particularly over the last four decades. Wages have been stagnant, and inequality has really grown tremendously. So people are saying we need a new system. And I even think the right wing helped it by calling Obama a socialist. And a lot of liberals, not even, you know, economic liberals like Sanders, but just social liberals that believe in social equality, said, well, I'm with Obama, and if he's a socialist, I must be too. So I think it's opened up the whole discussion. I mean, it used to be socialism as a word was a conversation stopper. I mean, I came up in the 50s during, you know, the McCarthy era, the Red Scare, and you couldn't talk about socialism without people wanting to get away from the conversation. Today, it's a conversation starter. So I think we have a real opportunity. We need to go beyond the kind of Sanders socialism to talk about, you know, the traditional socialist program of social ownership and democratic administration of the economy. And I think Sanders actually knows that. His Green New Deal proposal the other day had a lot of social ownership in it. And when he gets sort of pushed on the question, he says, well, none of this will happen unless the working class mobilizes, which is true. He just hasn't laid out, you know, that we really got to, you know, take social ownership of key sectors of the economy, which a full socialist program would do. But I think we're in a situation where we can do a lot of education on what socialism is, why it has to be democratic, why it has to be ecological, and how, why we need independent political action to get it. So that we, you know, we're not going to get that education and that allegiance to an alternative idea, an opposition, an alternative, without having an independent socialist movement and party.
You know, I spoke to a lady today, last week in the car business, which I'm so glad of that. I've been doing it for 31 years. And, you know, she's a retired nurse, but, you know, she's still looking at buying a car, hasn't bought a car in, since 2000. But here, you know, she'd say, well, you know, everything has worked well for me financially during my lifetime. She'd say, right now I don't have to finance a car. I'm worth approximately $6 million. How do you sell to a person like that, or many people that are doing well, and they're still working people, to say that, you know, if they believe in capitalism because it's been working for them, how do you tell them socialism is the direction that the nation should take? What is your message to a person like that, or the many people that are like that?
Well, there are a lot of things we can say. You'll be in a society with less crime and violence. You'll be safer. You'll be in a society with much better infrastructure and public services. So you want to take a train instead of your car to get around L.A. We used to have a trolley system, and the, you know, GM and the rest of them tore it up, replaced it with buses that they could sell, and L.A. is a big traffic jam now. So there's a lot of collective consumption that would be much better, public provision, that would be, you know, available to everybody. So I think those are, you know, two arguments. And, you know, I would appeal to them on a moral basis, you know, the same way, you know, the civil rights movement appealed to white folks who might have felt competition from blacks moving up, but said, boy, what we're seeing in this, you know, the way these people are being treated in the South, Bull Connor and them, that's just wrong. And capitalism is just wrong. You should not, you know, steal people's labor, the value they create. It's just wrong. Let's have a, you know, let everybody get the full fruits of their labor. And, you know, there are a lot of working people that have done good. They've saved up. They invested in the stock market. They come out pretty comfortable. But the fact is they only got about half of the value they created. You know, some capitalist sitting there as a billionaire got their money.
Right.
So they could be even better
and,
off.
And what I like what you say is collective, you know, not just what's in it for me, but what's in it for us. What is in it for us as a society? Because we got to live with these people in our communities. It's collective. Howie, you mentioned to our listeners a few minutes ago, you were talking about a eco-socialist Green New Deal. Obama, when he got in, they were throwing money at Obama, and they gave him $824 billion for his stimulus. When you look at when it went from Clinton to Bush, there was a stimulus for the economy. Between those two presidents, it was, when you look at the national debt, it went up over $12 trillion. $12 trillion between those two. Now it's well over $22 trillion. And so if you come in with a new plan, it's like, you know, where's the money going to come from? So when I look at, you know, an eco-socialist Green New Deal, I'm believe it's going to create jobs where, you know, it's going to help to clean the environment. It's going to deal with our infrastructure. It's going to deal with the various manufacturer where it won't be polluting the air. But what type of costs are we looking at in a Green New Deal over the next decade? What would it cost? What would the cost and also the benefits be as far as where it would be a savings to us as a society?
Well, my campaign's coming out with a budget for the Green New Deal in the next couple of weeks. We're real close to having it ready to present. And our bottom line numbers are the investment in transforming the economy, what I call the Green Economy Reconstruction Program, will be about $2.7 trillion a year. And it will create about 30 million jobs, mainly in manufacturing and construction. And this is a 10-year program to get to zero greenhouse gas emissions and 100% clean energy by 2030. It's a crash program, like we scaled up in World War II and built the arsenal of democracy by taking over a quarter of U.S. manufacturing or building it. It was nationally owned and planned during the war, and we need to do nothing less to address this climate issue. So, and we went into big debt because we had to win that war. Same thing with climate change. So that's one cost. The Economic Bill of Rights is about $1.3 trillion a year. That's ongoing expenses to cover, you know, Medicare and Medicare for All and free tuition at public colleges and expanding public housing so everybody has access to affordable housing. All those programs, it's about $1.3 trillion. So we're talking about $4 trillion a year. And we've got, and we'll show in this budget how we're going to raise that money. The largest share comes from more progressive taxation of income, wealth, assets, in estates. And we have some ecological taxes like a land value tax. The next biggest chunk is reordering the federal budget, cutting the military budget by 75% and putting that money into the Green New Deal. And then the rest, and it'll be about $1.2 trillion, we'll either have to borrow it, and it's cheaper to borrow it than not do this Green New Deal and have the climate come down on us and, you know, undermine ecosystems, agriculture, and eventually our whole civilization. So we've got to make this investment. And the Greens have a radical program that harkens back to the Greenback Party and the Greenback Labor Party and the Populist Party, or the People's Party, when they called for the federal government to issue money rather than have it issued by banks. And you can issue that money in the Treasury and spend it into the economy through government programs, investments in infrastructure as well as services. And that would be the way we expand money without borrowing. That would be interest-free money. The way the Federal Reserve now creates money is the Treasury issues bonds, and then the Reserve will buy those bonds on the secondary market to support the bond sales. And they also manipulate interest rates. But that is money that we have to pay back. You know, those bonds, eventually the Fed, even if they bought it, or the rest of us, have to pay back the Treasury. The Treasury has to pay back the bondholders, whether it's the Fed or the rest of
us. The bondholders, right.
Right. And that, people talk about it being an intergenerational transfer, and it is, but it's more than that, a class transfer, because who buys the bonds? Most of them are bought by the super rich. Well,
exactly.
The rich. And the taxes are paid
and
to pay off
the
bonds by the working class. So that is a transfer of wealth. It's better to tax the rich up front than to borrow money from them and pay interest for it. So that's why progressive taxation is in the lead. But to get this, you know, massive scale of investment going, we're going to have to either borrow it, sort of a green quantitative easing program, but this time we bail out people in the planet instead of the banks, But a better solution would be this monetary reform the Greens are talking about, and just issue greenbacks like we did to pay for the Civil War. And you know, the farmer labor, or the farmer labor populist movement was demanding greenbacks in the late 19th century. The economy was deflating, and the bankers wanted people to pay the money back in those deflated dollars, so they would get more, you know, value relative to what they lent. And it was killing the farmers. It was actually killing industry too. So we brought that demand back for a modern day greenback program.
We have approximately another 8 minutes here, and I just have a couple more questions. One of the things I look at, and you're talking about the Green New Deal, what the cost would be, and the benefits is going to outweigh that cost. But the same thing with when they had the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt, they were talking about the cost it was going to be, and they were talking about over the long term how it was going to be more beneficial, and it would pay for itself in the long run. I look at a project like the Hoover Dam. It was approximately 25 years ago. You know, it was completely satisfied, the cost of that. And then all the profits now still go to big corporations. It doesn't go to the people, the government that actually financed and paid for it. So that's something in the long term. You have to make certain that those funds don't, I mean, the benefits of creating an eco-socialist Green New Deal that in the long run, short term, where it creates jobs and a better society, a cleaner environment, that it doesn't end up being in the hands of the capitalists. Just a couple more questions. Knowing the Green Party as well as you do, Howie, is the Green Party, would you say, more progressive, liberal, or conservative?
Well, progressive. I'm not sure what the difference between liberal and progressive is. It's that progressive sort of been a euphemism for a coalition between socialists and liberals inside the Democratic Party, where the socialists kind of disappear. But it's always been progressive on social issues in terms of economic justice, more democracy, anti-U.S. imperialism. It's always been progressive. What's changed in the last decades is it now identifies as socialist or eco-socialist. And exactly what that means, I think, is an issue the Greens are still hashing out, just like the broader socialist movement is, as we discussed before. But it's definitely been on the left. And, I mean, there was some people saying we're neither left nor right, but in front. That's a slogan that was in the early German Greens from the faction that eventually formed a right-wing kind of eco-fascist fortress Europe party called the Ecological Democratic Party in Germany. It's very small. It has a few seats in, I think, Bavaria. But that slogan kind of people took it up because I think they thought they could please everybody with that slogan. But, you know, when you try to please everybody and don't take a stand, you really end up not pleasing too many people.
Right. As a candidate for president for 2020, where do you believe you will find your greatest support base outside of the Green Party? Will it be among other progressives outside of the Green, progressives, liberals, or conservatives? Where do you think you're going to find your support base?
Well, I think we will get, and it depends on who the Democratic nominee is. You know, like last time, Sanders, a lot of Sanders supporters came to the Green Party when it became clear that, he was going to back Clinton and Clinton was going to get the nomination. We could have a similar situation this time. There'll be a lot of people that, depending on what state they're in, they'll vote Green to send a message. The strongest anti-Trump vote is a Green vote because we have a program against Trumpism. You know, the Democrats could get elected, defeat Trump, but they won't defeat Trumpism. And by that, I mean, like, take the predatory racist banksters that Obama refused to prosecute and Holder refused to prosecute. Because they didn't, they're back in power now. I'm speaking of Steve Mnuchin running the Treasury Department, who was one of the biggest predatory lenders in the lead up to the Great Recession, and Wilbur Ross.
Another criminal.
Yeah, Wilbur Ross running Commerce. He was at the center. He had these mortgage servicing companies. He was at the center of the robo-signing scandal, which was literally stealing people's homes with false paperwork. And these guys are back in government, not just because Trump got elected, because the Democrats wouldn't prosecute. Look, if the Democrats were so worried about Trump, they'd have impeached him by now. I mean, the evidence is all in front of
them. They're
not
worried about him.
Yeah, well, you know, the guy's taking emoluments. He's obstructing justice. He's, you know, in contempt of Congress. And I liked Al Green, the representative from Texas's impeachment resolutions. He's a racist. He's not faithfully executing the laws, which were supposed to be non-discrimination. And he's inciting violence, getting people killed. That's enough to impeach him. He should have been impeached the first time Green brought that at the end of 2017. So if the Democrats were really about fighting Trump, they'd have done a lot more by now. So all I'm saying is, you know, a lot of people are going to decide in their state, they're going to vote Green because the Democrats will probably win that state anyway. So those are a lot of votes we'll get. But what I'm hoping to do as we get the Greens to be better organizers is reach into the people that aren't voting. You know, the majority of the working class, people of color, youth, don't vote. And it's not because they're apathetic, it's because they're alienated. They don't think it makes any difference. They don't think the politicians know what they're going through, care about them, can even see them. And that is where the left has to build its base. If we're going to have a left that takes power in this country, it's going to be on the backs of the working class majority, which is right now alienated. They're not participating so much. So I think in the long run,
well,
that's the base. That's the base.
Well, I had two more minutes, and I was going to ask you, it almost sounded like you had your closing statement. What in closing, what would you like to say about your campaign? I have 2 minutes, and I'd like for you to end with your contact information. Could you do that, please? Howie Hawkins, candidate for president 2020. Could you have the last word, please?
Well, we're running a campaign for peace, justice, and ecology, and we've talked about the programs. And this isn't going to work unless we build a small army of people. So I urge people to, you know, get off the couch and get involved. And that's how we're going to make a difference. We can't just talk about it on Facebook. We got to go out and talk to people face to face and go to events, organize events, canvas voters and all that. And the way to get involved is to go to HowieHawkins.us, our website. That's HowieHawkins.us. And you can read what we're about, you know, what we're saying, and you can give us the contact information and, you know, to volunteer or just to get our regular emails we send out. And you can donate. And our emails aren't just asking you for money like we seem to get from the other candidates. We're actually trying to, you know, talk about the issues that we face and what we can do about it. So I urge people to get involved. And the more of us get involved, the better we're going to do.
And I want to thank you once again, Howie, for joining the program. Howie will be joining us again in September, one of our programs in September, and also one of our programs in October. Howie Hawkins, 2020 candidate for President of the United States. And Howie, we are glad to have you as our guest today. We look forward to having you to join us once again. Again, I'd like to thank our listeners for joining us, and we look forward to having you to join us next week on Socialist Can, 1 hour left. Have a good evening, everyone. Thank you, Howie.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Good night.